Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country tonight, or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, become that you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio.
And welcome to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew, coming to you live from southern Mississippi. Our AccuWindow forecast, about 125 degrees outside, it seems, and the humidity is right up against it. So glad you could join us here tonight. It's really going to be an amazing show. One of my good friends, Kevin Smith, is going to be on with us in about half an hour, so I definitely don't want you to go away for that. That's really going to be good. We're going to be talking about Elenin, and we're going to be talking about recent NASA missions that have gone awry. You're going to like that segment, I promise you. No conspiracy theory. Okay, not much, but some amazing things you haven't seen. You've been enamored by the political debates going on. The solar wind tonight is blistering at 500 kilometers per second, and the proton count is way up to 5.3 per cubic centimeter. It's quite high. The odds of collision are about 500% higher than they were 2 weeks ago. So if you go outside in the sun, wear a shirt. Sunscreen won't help you against protons. It's only good for UV radiation. These protons are solid. They're not massless like the photons of ultraviolet light. Your shirt will stop them. Consider it Schedule 80 sunscreen. Bare skin is the unwanted target, let me tell you. If you feel the sun stinging, then obey your common sense. Sweat a little bit and save your skin the bath of protons striking the Earth at this time. In fact, this may be the last of your extended sunbathing for more than an hour for the rest of this solar cycle. Someone texted me a little while ago and said, how long is this solar cycle? Okay, it's about 10 years. So until further notice, wear a long sleeve shirt and a hat. By the way, the Earth dodged another solar bullet this week. An X-class flare erupted from sunspot 1261 and 1263, but they were not aimed at Earth when it happened. Whew. For about 2 days, the gargantuan sunspots were aimed at Earth like a double-barreled shotgun, but nothing happened. The two sunspots were crackling with M-class flares, about 100 times the diameter of Earth, when they passed over the western limb of the sun. We'll find out more in about 10 days when they roll around to face the Earth again. Right now they're faced away from us. The Solar Dynamics Observatory is watching very closely, and we shall see if they launch another major CME out into space. We just missed this one. And by the way, the Perseids peaking this weekend, but they're about half the normal number of meteorites. While we agree that the makeup of the ancient cometary tail is not consistent, it does make sense that as the years go on, the density of the particles in this tail, especially when it's exposed to solar and galactic winds, will decay. We may have seen the best of the Perseids. By the way, many of you have been asking me about Nibiru, planet X. We have been searching for some evidence of that other than just hyperbole. If you go to sky-map, skymap with a hyphen in the middle, .org, and you put in the search word Nibiru, you'll find an image of PGC 1427054, sees Nibiru. It's there. We don't know if it's approaching, going sideways, or the image is even at. It appears on this website that just about anybody can upload an image and associate it with something. But this could be a disclosure of sorts. Who knows? Who knows? Interesting stuff. By the way, in the news, it may soon be possible to wear your computer. Oh, thank goodness. I have a callus on my ear from my Bluetooth. I'm dreaming of the day when I can have it surgically implanted in my head. That way I can talk on the phone while I'm in the shower. I'm kidding. But with the invention of an ultra-thin and flexible electronic circuit that can be stuck to the skin like a temporary tattoo, it gets pretty interesting. I'm pretty amazed at the quality of this. You can look at some of the images on various news online magazines. The devices, which are almost invisible, can perform just as well as more conventional electronic machines, but without the need for wires or bulky power supplies, because you're the power supply. Isn't that cool? You never have to plug in and recharge. I think it's pretty cool. The development could mark a new era in consumer electronics. Yeah, I'll bet. Like neon tattoos that you can wear and light up with miniature LEDs all over your skin. Now that would be hot. The technology could be used for applications ranging from medical diagnosis to covert military operations. In fact, I believe that's where most of the funding and grant money is coming for these. The epidural electronic system. Epidural means your outer skin. Yeah, so if you really, it's a good line. You know, it is. Just walk up to somebody and say, "Excuse me, your epidermis is showing." Oh, you'll see them cover. Yeah, okay, well, they might know it's skin, but not likely. Anyway, the epidural electronic system relies on a highly flexible electrical circuit composed of snake-like conducting channels that can bend and stretch without affecting performance. I wonder if you could put performance-enhancing electronics onto the skin that make your muscles much more powerful than they normally are. I'll bet they're researching that, too. The circuit, that could be my answer. You know, I've been trying to invent spray abs for a long time. Yes, no, spray abs, like you go into a booth, and you walk out with a six-pack. Come on, tell me that wouldn't sell. It would. It would too. But if you could wear a circuit on your stomach at night that just kind of gently stimulates the muscles, not like that belt thing you see on the net, that doesn't work. That just is uncomfortable. No, I haven't tried it, but it just looks uncomfortable. This could be like spray abs, only better. The circuit is about the size of a postage stamp. It's thinner than a human hair and sticks to the skin by natural electrostatic forces rather than glue. Quote, "We think this could be an important conceptual advance in wearable electronics to achieve something that is almost unnoticeable to the wearer. The technology can connect you to the physical world and the cyber world in a very natural way that feels comfortable," said Professor Todd Coleman of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, who led the research team. Sick. This is sick. I love it. A simple stick-on circuit can monitor a person's heart rate and muscle movements as well as conventional medical monitors, but with the benefit of being weightless and almost completely undetectable. Scientists said it may also be possible to build a circuit for detecting throat movements around the larynx in order to transmit information wirelessly as a way of recording person's speech, even if they are not making any discernible sounds. Tests have already shown that such a system can be used to control a voice-activated computer game. I'll bet I know which game it was. And one suggestion is that a stick-on voice box circuit could be used in covert police operations where it might be too dangerous to speak into a radio transmitter. Oh, boy. Yeah, I'll bet you there are some very sophisticated war games being played with that. The blurring of electronics and biology is really the key point here, said Yonggang Huang, professor of engineering at Northwestern University in Evanston, Illinois. So Illinois is getting all the grant money. All established forms of electronics are hard, rigid. Biology is soft, elastic. Unless they're incorrigible, of course, then they're stiff-necked. It's two different worlds. This is a way to truly integrate them. Ooh, electronic integration with human biology. Cyberdyne systems, here we come. Engineers have built test circuits mounted on a thin, rubbery substrate that adheres to the skin. Can you say AI? The circuits have included sensors, light-emitting diodes, transistors, radio frequency capacitors, wireless antennas, conductive coils, and solar cells. We threw everything in our bag of tricks on to that platform, and then added a few other new ideas on top of those to show that we could make it work, said John Rogers, professor of engineering at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, a lead author of the study. Published in the journal Science, this email is my personal stuff. I have no idea how I copied and pasted it in there, but I'm not going to read that part to you. Copying or forwarding this email is not permitted. That's what the last line says. So this is sort of like an electronic skin tattoo. What do you think? I want you to join me on this program tonight from start to finish. We're going to do some of the most leading edge. Some of it can be, you know, a little frightening. Like, I'm trying to be humorous with this, but where could we go with this? What kind of money could be put behind this? Do you think this is something Sony Media is going to jump behind with Call to Glory or, you know, WWF or something like that? Or do you think the real money going behind these microelectronics is going to come from darker sources? Our toll-free number anywhere in North America is 888-429-5471. 888-429-5471. Now, if you're outside that toll-free area, if you can get close to a cell phone tower, whether you're on planet or off planet, you can reach us at 530-413-4515. And increasingly, we have a lot of very close listeners to the program who dial in because they don't want to be hooked to their laptop. They don't want to be immobile. They don't want to worry about Wi-Fi. You can call 760-569-7676. 760-569-7676. And then dial the access code 192-919-POUND. 192-919-POUND. If you do that, you can listen to this program live with your Bluetooth. No one around you need know. Except, of course, by your elated facial expressions, which you will have spontaneously throughout the program. Yeah. Now, somebody could walk up to you. Hey, are you listening to X Squared Radio? I noticed your facial expression. You could do that and listen to the program, and then you could walk out into, well, what many call the real world, and you'll be listening to the program in a clandestine manner along with thousands of other listeners. We can take an unlimited number in this conference room, so feel free to dial in and listen. So this is a technology that blurs the distinction between electronics and biology. Mr. John Rogers says, our goal was to develop an electronic technology that would integrate the skin in a way that is mechanically and physiologically invisible to the user. And if it's invisible to the user, it's probably going to be invisible to people around you. So if you think that the world of surveillance has reached a limitation, you are sadly mistaken. Yeah. And it's not only humans that can wear this stuff. They want to monitor you, and they have circuitry this small. I would watch what you say around the nearest dragonfly. Pretty interesting stuff. In about 12 minutes, my good friend Kevin Smith is going to come on the program. We're going to dial him up from Scottsdale, Arizona, and he is going to join us. We are going to discuss several leading-edge technologies, not the least of which is the detection of Nibiru. But this week, we had the second test of the unmanned hypersonic glider developed for U.S. defense research into a super-fast global strike capability craft. In case you didn't catch the news, they didn't cover it much on the mainstream media. You had to kind of go a little bit into the fringe, and you had to really be looking for this stuff. You're going to find out about the Falcon Hypersonic Technology Vehicle 2 tonight, and we're going to go into details that and ask some questions that some of you have sent in, most of you have wondered about, and we're going to cover it from an angle that's going to really open to your eyes what is going on, what can go on, what level of conflict we really are in our country, in our world. Many of you have written in and asked, and I've asked myself on this program, why do we need a $1.3 trillion annual defense budget? I didn't have an answer. I mean, who are we fighting out there? A few nameless cowards who want to strike, like swatting a toe with a hammer and then walk away and see its enemy hop around on one foot for a while, thinking that they've somehow, in their twisted, cowardice minds, that they have won the war, like there is even a war. We have a war on terror by being terrible ourselves. Yeah, and we need $1.3 trillion for that. I doubt it. I doubt it. Why would we be putting such high-tech weaponry in place to chase down a 1976 Datsun with a 50 caliber machine gun bolted to it? I doubt it. I'm not buying it, as Bill O'Reilly would say. I want you to join me tonight, and I want you to participate. That means picking up the phone and giving us a call. I want you to ask your questions. I'm going to cover political science a little bit. Those of you that are interested in this, you know the Iowa caucus just had their straw poll this Saturday. Some rather historic events happened during the poll. Despite millions of dollars being spent and years, literally years, preparation to make this straw poll in 2011, the results were very elusive to the prognosticators. Frontrunner Mitt Romney didn't even show up on the leaderboard. It doesn't surprise me when the first two words out of his mouth to every question, including what time of day is it, are this president. Yeah, just fill in the blank from there. Surprising was that Michelle Bachmann won the straw poll, although even more surprising, exponentially surprising, was that she only won 152 votes, despite voting place activists urging the undecided to vote for Bachmann. It doesn't hurt that she's been there for 2 years and spent a lot of money to get this voting going, to get her activists, to get her street people lining the curb up to the millimeter before the forbidden zone. Only 152 votes. But what the press is not telling you is that she only beat Ron Paul by 152 votes, and he's only been there for 38 days. Spent almost no money. Yes, his followers and activists are rather vocal, and they're, you know, chanting in the background, making all the noise in the auditoriums, but that's not why. That's not why. There's no rock bands. The people of Iowa have seen every candidate for the last 100 years. The people of Iowa have chosen to have their caucus, their straw poll, before anyone else is in the country because they want to meet all the candidates. And they do. And when you go there, you better hit every barbecue place, kiss every baby, go to every school, every event, every parade, stand on every street corner. Is it possible? Yeah, maybe. I mean, you could shake every hand within 100 miles of Ames, Iowa, and still not win, as is evident from Mr. Pawlenty and others who have spent a lot of time there and did not place in the top two. By the way, Mr. Pawlenty pulled out today, and he placed third. Close. First and second were 152 votes apart, and Mr. Pawlenty was hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of votes behind Mr. Ron Paul. Very interesting stuff. Because of the candidates who are running in this primary, and by the way, one just got in yesterday, Mr. Perry from Texas, disrespected Iowans by entering on the day of their straw poll, not participating in the system, and competing for the press. But Mr. Ron Paul is the only one with his politics. He's the only one talking about the Fed. He's the only one talking about a complete withdrawal from Iraq. He's the only one talking about the return to the gold standard and dissolving hundreds of thousands of federal jobs and reducing the size of government, which is exactly where the cuts should be taking place. Not in entitlements, not in Medicare, not in Medicaid, not in Social Security. In the vast oceans of federal employees, that's where the cuts should take place. And Ron Paul is the only one talking about that. Interesting. Enough. Well, in about 5 minutes, is going to join us. I know you're fingernail, and I am too, because what we're going to talk about is going to blow your mind. Earth's two moons. It's not lunacy, but new theory. Outside experts said the idea makes sense, but they aren't completely sold yet. This all supposedly happened about 4.4 billion years ago, long before there was any life on Earth to gaze up and see, observe, the strange sight of dual moons. The moons themselves were young, formed about 100 million years earlier when a giant planet smashed into Earth. This is one theory. I don't buy into it, but I'm reading it to you. They both orbited Earth and sort of rose in the sky together, the smaller one trailing a few steps behind a little sister in tow, until the moon reached around like the big tomato to the small tomato and hit him on the head and said, catch up. The smaller one was a planetary lightweight. The other was 3 times wider and 25 times heavier. Its gravity so strong that the smaller one just couldn't resist, even though it was parked a good bit away. I got to tell you, this guy's name really cracks me up. I'm going to name my next pet this. Okay, this is a quote. They're destined to collide. There's no way out. The big splat is a low-velocity collision, said study co-author Eric Asfog. I am not kidding you. Eric Asfog, a planetary scientist at the University of California, Santa Cruz. I am definitely naming my next dog Asfog. It's got to be. What Asfog calls a slow crash is relative. It appears it happened at about 5,000 miles an hour, but that's about as slow as possible when you're talking planetary smash-ups. Asphog said, it's sorry, it's slow enough that the rocks didn't melt. And because the smaller moon was more than 600 miles wide, the crash took a while to finish, even at 5,000 miles an hour. Asphog likened the smaller moon to a rifle bullet and said people would be bored looking at it because it's taking 10 minutes just for the bullet to bury itself in the moon. This is an event. If you're looking at it, you'd need a bag of popcorn. The rocks and crust from the smaller moon would have spread over and around the bigger moon without creating a crater, as a faster crash would have done. The physics is really surprising. Similar to, and I love this part too, similar to a pie in the face, Asphog said. And about a day later, everything was settled and the near and far sides of the moon looked different, Asphog said. Co-author, now this name isn't nearly as catchy, co-author Martin Jutzi of the University of Bern in Switzerland said the study was an attempt to explain the odd crust and mountainous terrain on the moon's far side, which is, as you know, because you've seen photos of it, just plastered with all kinds of small craters and mountains. Asphog noticed it looked as if something had been added to the surface. And by the way, if you look at the two sides of the moon, one is very dark, actually has an albedo of about 10, and the other side of the moon has an albedo of about 60. Albedo is the amount of energy that's reflected back out into space. So the duo started running computer simulations of cosmic crashes. The theory was the buzz this week in the Woods Hole, Massachusetts, as at a conference of scientists working on NASA's next robotic mission to the moon, said H.J. Melosh of Purdue University. We can't find anything wrong with it, Melosh said. It may or may not be right. Well, it's a big what if. It's a big what if. I kind of like it. All right, my good friend Kevin Smith is going to join us in about 1 minute. Our phone lines are 888-429-5471. That's toll-free anywhere in North America. If you live outside of that area, you can reach us, if you can get to a cell phone tower, 530-413-4515. 530-413-4515. That works east or west of Earth, by the way. If any of you need to step away from the computer, no worries. Dial us up, 760-569-7676, and then the access code 192919#, and you can listen via Bluetooth. And very soon, you'll be able to have that Bluetooth tattooed on your skin with no adhesive, and you can walk around. And by the way, you never have to plug in because your skin, the electricity from your own skin will power it up. I think that's so cool. I'm first in line. I graduated first in my class, alphabetically, of course. Want to make sure you're paying close attention as we get Kevin Smith on the program. We wouldn't want to lose you. Anything could happen, and we most definitely will be going past your imagination. Well, I hope you're out there. I'm not seeing a clock running on the phone, on the Skype, so I'm not exactly sure if we're on or off. Yes, we're on. We're on, we're connected, we're rolling, and we should have Kevin Smith any moment. Yeah, that's so cool. All right, well, as it turns out, there's a new bird out. Well, I don't know. We want to try another phone connection. I'm getting 3 bars on the modem, and it looks like it's working pretty good. I apologize for the sound quality. All right, Kevin Smith is with me. Kevin Smith, are you there?
I am. I am here.
Ah, excellent. All right. Kevin Smith, as many of you know, has his own program, kevinsmithshow.com, kevinsmithshow.com. Kevin Smith is a longtime friend and is actually my mentor in this business of talk radio. I would not be here. I would not have the quality of sound that I have or the format that I have or have the presence on the radio that I have if it was not for Kevin. And I want to extend my thanks to him for his training and mentoring. Thank you.
Well, you're certainly welcome. Certainly welcome. And I have to say this. There have been several folks who have asked my opinion and advice on a few things to help them get started. None have done better with that than you have.
Well, I appreciate that. I'm a quick study, and I just learn well and stick with it. By the way, the studio is asking if there's any way you can raise your volume just a little bit. He can amp you up a little bit.
Is that any better right there?
Well, I think you're crystal clear, and you're fine as far as my recording, but I want to make sure the studio is happy.
Yeah.
So. All right. See if you can raise it up a little bit.
Well, I've got you at max.
All right, we'll try that. He has control over the incoming channels, and we can raise it up a little bit, and we'll just try to get too much feedback from it. One of the interesting things that happened this week, we had an unmanned hypersonic glider that was launched, and this was actually the second launch of this aircraft. We didn't even know about the first until now. Let me just read this one section. The small craft is part of a U.S. military initiative to develop technology to respond to threats at 20 times the speed of sound or greater, reaching any part of the globe in an hour. All right, I'm going to lower my gain so we can match up a little bit better. There we go. I lowered my microphone sound just a little bit, and we'll see if that works, and we can match up the sounds a little bit better. We'll see. Hang on just one second, listeners, while we take care of technical difficulties. Go ahead, Kevin, and speak just a little bit, and we'll try to match the sound.
All right. I really don't know what you want me to say, but there's some audio for you.
That was perfect. That's exactly what I wanted you to say. All right. I think I'm getting a 5x5 here. And I think the studio's happier with that. Okay. I'm going to lower my gain just a little bit more. Okay. That's it. That's about as low as I can make my voice and me still be able to hear myself. All right. I think the studio's got it. All right. Let me make sure that my sound level is good on... Oh, yeah, I'm looking good, looking good. No feedback, no clipping, everything's good. Yes, yes. Okay, the studio's scolding me a little bit, but that's okay. We're going to carry on. This craft is really amazing. If you look at the pictures of it on the Internet, it looks like something right out of UFO Digest. The HTV, as it's known, 2, is designed to be launched to the edge of space, separate from its booster, and maneuver through the atmosphere at 13,000 miles per hour before intentionally crashing into the ocean. DARPA used Twitter to announce the launch and status of the flight. Twitter. Can you believe it that there are people that are following Twitter and it's dun-dun-dun, we're launching now. The agency said the launch of the Minotaur 4 rocket was successful and separation was confirmed. It next reported that telemetry had been lost. What's going on, Kevin? A $400 million piece of technology lost at sea? That sounds peculiar to me. What's up?
Well, there's always the possibility that, a slim possibility, that they've told us the truth. But it's a slim possibility, and I don't buy it. Shall I share with you why I don't buy it?
No. Of course, yes, yes, share, okay. Share.
The reason I don't buy it is because we have too many examples of classified high technology from the past. The SR-71, commonly called the Blackbird, that was so highly classified that when it was deployed in 1965, they didn't even admit they had it. They never officially admitted they had it till they were ready to retire it in the late 80s. And when they finally did admit they had it, they told us that its top speed and all of its technical specifications were classified, so they wouldn't tell us what its top speed was. That plane is retired. It is retired, and its top speed is still classified. All right. Now here we come with a hypersonic, way far and above the SR-71 in capability. And suddenly, they go on Twitter and tell everybody in the world that it can reach speeds of 13,000 miles per hour. When the SR-71 that is retired is classified. So the only thing this could possibly mean is that they're going to let us know, they're going to let the world know, for perhaps political reasons, that we're going to do 13,000 miles per hour with this. That doesn't mean it's the top speed. That means that's as much as they're going to let us know.
Uh-huh. So it's 5 miles an hour faster than anything any of our enemies have thought about flying, but it's capable of doing a lot more than that.
Well, I think so. I think it has to be that. Why would you announce to the world that it's got a top speed of 13,000 when you want to announce to the world what the SR-71 can do and it's retired? That's not its top speed. I would bet the bank on it. That's not its top speed by a long chalk.
Hmm. Well, it probably isn't. And I would say, even though they're retired, I think they're all still in good working order, put away in the garage for that case in which we have to call upon it.
Yeah.
How is it that they made this little error? I mean, you know, a nice little addition for to think about here is that we've had other launches. Back in 2006, we launched a satellite with a innovative fuel supply and optics that were superior beyond anything we've ever put in space. A few hours after it was put into orbit, it mysteriously was shut down. We have no idea what hit it, what knocked it out. I mean, this thing was hardened every way that you could harden a military satellite. And it had optics that could count the number of human hairs on the forearm from where it was sitting in space. Somebody on this planet or off this planet didn't want that satellite to work. This satellite was so advanced that the Navy was ordered to shoot the thing down. And in 2008, they did so. They modified an anti-missile missile, and they shot that satellite down out of space because they didn't want those optics nor that fuel supply to fall into the wrong hands. Just a few months ago, we launched a super secret mission to Pakistan using stealth helicopters, two of them. The first one, they say, crashed on landing. It was disabled. So everybody piles on the second craft after shooting a guy in his pajamas in the face, if you believe that too, took his body to sea and dumped it, and they blew up the first helicopter almost. The tail rotor of it was quickly photographed and immediately put on Facebook or sold to the Chinese, whichever you believe. It seems to me that our very best stealthy leading-edge technology gets put out there within minutes of us launching it. So that's three top-secret, not counting the SR-71, and by the way, the F-117 stealth fighter was released by Revell as a model before anyone even knew the plane existed. So what's going on, Kevin? Why is it that we're spending such money on craft that can fly so fast that when you make a left-hand turn, it splats the occupants against the right-hand window?
Well, first, I think this hypersonic aircraft is in a whole different class of strangeness, a different class of strangeness than the satellites. For this reason, there had to be some reason why they decided to publicize to the world that they were going to do this test flight. This is the second test flight. The first one, they say it failed. Okay, if it did, would you want the press to be there in the event of another colossal failure at $400 million? Would you want the press to be there to see that failure? Wouldn't you normally, if you're going to release it to the press, wait till you have a successful flight, and then the next flight is the one you tell the press about so that you already know you've got the bugs worked out? That's the way it's normally done. But, be that as it may, we have the first one that they said was a failure. The second one, they announced to the world that they're going to do the test flight. And what's interesting about it, as I pointed out, they announced to the world what its top speed is.
Well, what doesn't make sense to me is where exactly did this plane go when they lost telemetry?
Well, I don't know, and I don't think they lost telemetry with it. That's the point. Don't you think it's interesting that the instant it hit 13,000 miles per hour, which they had announced, then the telemetry goes out? I think that there is, granted, Brooks, I have a warped and convoluted view of these things, but I think there's every possibility here that it hit 13,000. That proved to the world, hey, we said we can do it, we can do it. You see that? We just did it. Then the telemetry, by pre-plan, is cut. And perhaps on a private, secured telemetry channel, the test continues above 13,000 miles per hour. I think that's possible. Had they not announced, look, here's the key. Had they not announced that it had, its top speed was 13,000, I wouldn't be suspicious. But they did announce it, when they still won't tell you about the SR-71. There's a reason why. I don't know what the reason is, but there's a reason why. They wanted somebody to know, we're going to do what nobody else can do, you watch. And as soon as we did it and proved it, the telemetry's cut, and I don't think they lost this craft. I think there had to be. I mean, they proved their point to whoever they were trying to prove it to.
One of my listeners, right? Yeah, the question is, you know, one of my listeners writes in and says, why did they build it? I mean, to carry weapons, to take pictures, or, you know, to show off-worlders, yeah, we can fly at 13,000 miles an hour, too.
Well, all of the above. The name of this craft is HTZ. The T, typically, in any aircraft stands for transport. For instance, we call the space shuttle the space shuttle, but that's not what it's called. It's called the STS, which is Space Transport System. And so typically the T stands for transport, which means it's generally planned for this to be a manned craft. When you look at HTV, it would be hypersonic transport vehicle. Are we trying to prove to off-worlders that we can fly faster than 13,000? They know that. But perhaps we just wanted to show off. I think that this craft flies a great deal faster than 13,000 miles per hour.
Well, you know, I guess the thing that we wonder about, think about national defense, we think about is what is the Pentagon doing when they have to sue Congress for access to space-based optics that have a resolution tighter than 1.3 meters. I think they have access to 2 meters, and they're suing for access to get access, suing to get access to the 1.3 meter resolution. My question is, you know, why would the Pentagon have to sue Congress to get access to that? And the second question is, if the Pentagon can't get access to 1.3 meter resolution on this planet, who does have access to it?
Well, that's a good question, and I think it's an interesting, interesting sort of a problem there. You know, constitutionally, the Pentagon can only do what Congress allows them to do and authorizes them to do. I was not aware that anyone was paying attention to the Constitution anymore, so that's good news. I'm glad they're having to sue.
Well, the crazy thing is that you've got the separation of powers, which puts the president as the commander-in-chief, and then you have Congress calling the agencies inside the Pentagon to task at various committees like, I mean, there's a very well-publicized congressional inquiry that's done by the ever-skillful Sheila Jackson Lee. Sorry, I have to laugh. I'm sorry, I had to pull my tongue out of my cheek. To ask Rumsfeld, what did he do with $2.2 trillion? And Rumsfeld just smiled, laughed, and looked back above his bifocals and said to her, "We lost it." So, you know, a few days later, 9/11 happened, and the attack just happened to be in the accounting wing of the Pentagon.
Kind of
and all those records, it was going to be an inquiry.
Yeah, it's an interesting situation. Very interesting. But our capabilities in space, our true capabilities, if you and I could know them, if the general public could know them, would make NASA look like horse and buggy. It really would.
Yeah, you know, there are people, especially listeners to your program, the Kevin Smith Show, and mine, that firmly believe that NASA is just the dog and pony. They're the booth at the fair, you know, to let people come and hit the striker and try to ring the bell. There's a whole other, much more well-funded high-tech space program, as is evident by this apparent flight of the HTV-2. That goes on behind the scenes that has a much higher capability than anything we've ever seen before. It makes the space shuttle look like a school bus.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it really does. And And, you know, what's interesting about this is the secret space program is just beginning to peek through into the public now with this HTV. Now, I think they would say, well, this is not a space vehicle. And again, for what it's worth, if we believe that, we're having to take the word of people who we've caught lying to us for as many decades as they've been in existence. So,
yeah, but all they'll do is
a space vehicle.
They won't say we were lying.
Yeah.
They won't say we were lying. They say lies were told. We're sorry. Lies were told.
Perhaps we were a bit inaccurate with that. We said it was not a space vehicle, and we're sorry that Hubble caught a picture of us with that vehicle on Mars. Obviously, misstatements were made.
One of my listeners writes in and says, it only goes faster than 13,000 miles an hour. Then this puppy goes plasma and disappears and reappears in minutes. And I wrote back and said, yes, minutes before it launched.
Brooks, I told you in a private conversation, about information that was told to me. And I told you the source that came through, and I won't repeat that here on the air. But I would have to say that it was reliable. Although I cannot vouch for it, I can't say that I know this to be true because I don't have access to this kind of information. But I was told through a reliable source about a craft that we have that can fly, take off without it. It's not a rocket, but it takes off from Earth like an aircraft and can fly from here to Mars in 5.5 hours. Because of the source, the channel through which that information came, I would have to say I think that's probably reliable information.
So from Earth to Mars in 5.5 hours without a Minotaur 4 rocket plume to go with it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Let me tell you, one of the things that I have said, just to give you an example of how that might be possible, one of the things I've said many times, and you've probably heard me say, is that if people are coming here from other star systems, they're traveling at speeds so fast they would be outrunning their own radio waves. So they cannot be communicating with radio waves, even the highest frequency radio waves. They have to be communicating with some other type of device. I talked with someone who was involved with...
that's right, because they would not be able to use regular light speed communication because that takes how long?
Well, look, if you're flying at twice the speed of light, you're outrunning your own communications by twice. So, in other words, you radio home and then they radio a message. It takes however long for say it takes 3 days for the message to get back home. They respond, it takes 3 days for it to get back to where it started from, but you've moved forward at twice that speed. It's never going to catch you. So there has to be some other way. I talked with a guy who was involved with someone who developed gravity wave communication and actually built some gravity communicators, gravity wave communicators, for this person, and told me they really do work, and they're instantaneous. They're not speed of light. They're instantaneous. Now, this is someone who was doing this on his own, not as part of the government machinery, okay? If it can be done basically in somebody's basement, you can bet your boots the military has it. If it's that simple, you bet they've already got it. If they can communicate using gravity waves, why can't they use gravity waves as propulsion?
The person whom you're trying to...
Ladies and gentlemen, I do apologize. We're trying to get Dr. Agnew back. Are you still with us, Kevin?
I am.
Stick around. Can carry on. You're going to have to do it without Dr. Agnew for a little while until he can get his connection fixed, okay?
Oh, okay.
Excellent.
Well, I'll sit in for the good doctor for just a minute or two here while you get Dr. Agnew back with us. So, you know, the point of this, folks, is things that you've read about as being sort of science fiction and it doesn't really exist. It does really exist. It really does exist. A lot of it. Another example is, you know, you remember in all the Star Trek movies, we saw replicators, you know, you go in and you program it, it looks like a little microwave box or something, you program it for a cup of tea, and it replicates and creates a cup of tea. They say, someday we may have this. Well, we do have it. We already do have it. Now, it doesn't create a cup of tea, but you can take anything like a tool and have this machine scan it as a copy machine would, and it creates that tool out of polymers in a matter of minutes, and so it replicates it. So a lot of the Star Trek stuff, the futuristic stuff, you think it can't possibly exist. Someday, maybe. A lot of it, we've got it. It's in use, and you just don't know about it yet. Is Dr. Agnew back with us? I guess not. So how do I know about that? Well, on my show, we talk about and offer a free newsletter. And I put video links in there every week. And about 3 weeks ago, I put a video link to that replicator in our newsletter. So all of our subscribers got to click the link and watch the thing in action. It actually works. They tell us that it's going to be years and years and years before they can actually do transporter room, you know. Beam me up, Scotty. But I'm hearing from people that should be in a position to know that say it already exists. So how does this play with, how does it relate to the launch of this HTV-2B? Well, the way it relates to the launch of the HTV-2B is that whatever they have allowed you to see,
right, let's try
the
that.
Bottom
do we have
end
a call?
Of the scale. It's the lower end of the scale. And so whatever their propulsion
right, well,
system is for this thing, it's way above what they said publicly. Dr. Agnew, are you back with us?
Yes, I'm back. It must be raining outside. It rains on the string that connects this hotel to the internet. So.
Okay, well, we did not have dead air there, so I'll punt back to you now.
Well, if this is, you know, not the first time we've had a super secret space project, you know, lost just after deployment, and we've been, you know, marginally open with the public, saying, yes, we have the SR-71, and it goes faster than Mach 3, the rest is classified. Now we come out and we boastingly say, yeah, we could do 13,000 miles an hour. But
which, by the way, is Mach 20.
Yeah, that's Mach 20. I always wondered why those SR-71 pilots had to wear space suits when they're flying that thing.
Now you know. But what I was saying while you were being reconnected is that a lot of the stuff that we think is Star Trek-ish and futuristic and fictional actually exists and is in use. And I think that could include gravity wave propulsion.
Well, that's very interesting. One of my listeners writes in and said, ask him about the gravity being able to be used for communication, faster than thought communication, by the way it sounds. How would that work? We were talking about, you know, regular communication between Mars and Earth with a craft that can arrive at Mars in 5.5 hours. I don't think you would be able to use radio waves as a method of communication.
Okay, your audio broke up real bad for most of that. I don't know what the question is. I'm sorry.
The question was, if we have craft that can go between Earth and Mars in 5.5 hours, what kind of ground control communication would we use? We couldn't use regular radio.
No, you would have to use gravity wave communication. You would have to use something that travels as fast as the propulsion system of that craft.
Wow. Maybe we would use beryllium ion modems and use what is called entangled particle theory for communication.
Well, yeah, and that's another thing I've brought up, is the entangled particle theory being used for communication. I don't see why it could not be. I don't know how technologically you would make it happen. But if you can measure that and know it, you can manipulate it some way. And if you can measure it, you are manipulating it. And you just figure out other ways to manipulate it and use it for communication. I don't see why not.
Well, I don't see why not either. And if they have the budget to launch a plane with this kind of speed, maybe they have the technology to do that kind of communication. Kevin, can you hang with me through a 3 or 4 minute break while we...
Absolutely.
Hear some stuff?
Excellent.
Excellent, excellent, excellent. All right. We're going to take a quick break, 4 minutes, let the internet clean itself up. I'm going to go out and dry off the cables so that Comcast can go ahead and get our internet sped up a little bit. And we'll be right back after this. Don't go away. We'll be back with more X Squared Radio in just a moment. Explorers, I mentioned that I was going to recite a poem to you by Gary McGregor. He's a local poet here in Hattiesburg. Rather aged, but has a poem here in his book called Only a sweet olive tree in summer. I thought I'd read it to you, let you retrospect just a little bit. In the summer of 43, and every summer before, a sweet olive tree blossomed in our yard. Soft bouquet wafting through the house like the collective perfume of a dozen southern bells. Radios played the laughs of Fibber McGee and Molly, Amos and Andy, the somber news of war in between. 10 miles south of town, in the piney woods, men rehearsed to kill other men and upholstered our streets with uniforms on weekends. We weeded victory gardens like patriotic puppets, tore stamps from ration books for meat and gasoline, while Europe's cities burned, her people scattered in the ashes. Small flags were hung in windows by wives and mothers, a star for each son or father who went off to war. A telegram, their greatest fear. Is it so unreasonable that my best memory of those grievous years is only a sweet olive tree in summer? Gary McGregor, Hattiesburg, Mississippi. Thank you for your view of the past, bringing those things to our remembrance. Welcome back to Hour 2 of X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew, coming to you live from southern Mississippi, just about 40 miles north of the Gulf of Mexico. Our AccuWindow window forecast, hot and humid still. Hopefully our internet will do much better this hour, and we appreciate you being here with us. If you want to join us, you can call toll-free anywhere in North America, 888-429-5471. My guest is Kevin Smith. He has his own radio program every night at 8 p.m. Central, I believe. And that is... What is that? 9 p.m. Central. And that is every single night of the week. That's why we are so graced by having him here tonight on the weekend, because he doesn't do the weekend programs unless he comes on here. KevinSmithShow.com. KevinSmithShow.com. Anywhere else on planet or off planet, if you can reach a cell phone tower, you can get to us 530-413-4515. And many, many, many of you are out there listening by cell phone. You cannot communicate with us, but you can listen. 760-569-7676. Dial the access code 192-919-pound. You'll get all the sound quality while you're walking around with your Bluetooth or your skin receiver. If you are so, if you hit the latest electronic store, maybe you can get your hands on that. What we were talking about was the new HTV-2 aircraft, which apparently was funded and launched by DARPA. And tweeted to the world, hey, we're going to launch from Vandenberg Air Force Base in California today. The Falcon HTV-2 unmanned aircraft scheduled to launch into space at hypersonic speeds as part of a critical test flight, measuring just 12 feet in length. Wow, that's about the length of a sports car. The HTV-2 maxes out at a speed of 13,000, actually it maxes out at 16,700 miles per hour. That's Mach 22, theoretically allowing it to jet from New York to Los Angeles in just 12 minutes. Now, that's my kind of travel. And to reach anywhere in the world in less than an hour, obviously, to make all of our enemies and would-be enemies quake in their boots. The main obstacle, however, has been transitioning from theory to practice. During its first test flight back in April, the craft lasted just 9 minutes before intentionally crashing due to technical failures. DARPA still doesn't know what went wrong during that fateful test, though the agency speculates that the Falcon may have simply overheated. This time around, engineers have adjusted the plane's center of gravity and angle of descent in hopes that their creation will fare better when it launches on the back of a Minotaur 4 rocket later today. That was this week. If the test proves successful, it may help fuel similarly intergalactic defense projects that the Pentagon is exploring as a means to combat terrorism in enemy states. I'm sorry, intergalactic defense project? On what world are they trying to combat terrorism?
Yeah. Oh, that's an interesting little bit of faux pas disclosure there. I've been told, you probably have too, by numerous guests, that we do have a deep space fleet. One of the interesting things that we know that we have, and it's a matter of public documents, is the space-based space surveillance system. It's not a space-based Earth surveillance, it's space-based space surveillance system. And it's a network, a fleet of 10 optical satellites. Their purpose is to, and I quote, identify and track deep space forces for both offensive and defensive purposes. Okay, deep space. It's supposed to identify and track deep space forces. Who's out there?
Yeah, what are we talking about, deep space? We're talking about deep space to the moon? Are we talking about deep space outside our solar system? Are we trying to send a message, hey, don't tread on us?
Well, I think deep space refers to anything beyond Jupiter, doesn't it?
Well, I mean, that makes sense to me. That's,
yeah.
You know, Jupiter's 80 million miles away.
Even, let's just say that this is even something that's just looking, say, out as far as Jupiter. I still have a question, so who's out there? Who are you going to identify and track? Who's coming?
Hmm. That is really interesting. One of my listeners picked up on the word intergalactic. And
yeah.
They mentioned the word SETI, like the search for intelligence, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. I think that search is over because we're already spending money on DARPA weapon systems to defend ourselves against, and I'm going to quote this again, intergalactic defense projects that the Pentagon is exploring. You know, excuse me, when did the producers of Star Trek and Star Wars become regulars at the Pentagon? What's going on? We haven't heard anything about any galactic, intergalactic presence. Intergalactic presence?
Yeah. And you know, this is one of the things that I have a lot of fun with on my show, and that is to I scoff at the scoffers. Look, people who think that there's still a question as to whether there's extraterrestrial intelligent life, they think there's still some question. These people have had their head in the sand. I mean, the documentation exists. Listen, back, I forget when it was. The 1970s or 1980s. The NSA's number one cryptologist, their top guy, gave a series of talks at the NSA to NSA scientists. The preface his remarks before he began his presentation on decoding extraterrestrial messages was, there was a time when it was hotly debated as to whether there are extraterrestrial intelligent beings. This is no longer a debate by serious minds.
Well, do we have any idea what the home address is?
I think they do.
You know, not long ago there was the appearance of unquestionably what was classified UFOs, unidentified flying objects, in the daytime over New York City. I think it was in October. And the news media was out on the street corner interviewing people, and they were turning their cameras skyward, although they weren't doing a lot of zooming. And it wasn't a short exposure. It was minutes, you know, a couple of hours that these craft were up there. And people were, you know, standing around the hot dog stand, you know, eating the kraut and the dog, going, hey, that's pretty wild. I mean, isn't this a city that gets a little nervous when something unidentified flies over? And haven't they had some recent unpleasantness with that? I asked the question, and I had Nick Pope on the program, and then I brought James Gilliland in on top of that, had them both on at the same time, and I asked the question because, you know, Nick Pope is being the former Minister of Defense for the UK, and now he serves on the other side of the fence as a member of the press, and I asked him, how come nobody took a news helicopter up there to 10,500 feet and zoomed in on these things to try to see what they were? I mean, what's going on? And Nick said, well, they're not really interested in getting that kind of information. And I said, but Nick, you know, this is Pulitzer Prize-winning stuff here. Why not take Channel 5's helicopter up there and get a shot of this thing? Are you kidding? Talk about, you know, market share. There's no question you'd have market share if you had something like that on live TV. Right outside our window, zooming in, is, are you crazy? Everyone would drop what they were doing and turn to your TV program. Plus, there was no military, nothing, no planes, no nothing, scrambled to go up there and find out what these things were. It was evident to me that these UFOs were as present as they wanted to be in broad daylight for a long period of time. What's going on?
Well, there are a couple of things there. First of all, the reason the news media didn't do it, Nick Pope is right, they're not interested. And the reason they're not interested is because, in my opinion, they are completely, totally, absolutely, abjectly, through and through, inside and out, controlled by the Pentagon. That's my opinion. And if they are told you're not interested in that, then they're not interested in it. That's why we get news. We have big events happening around the world. But here in the United States, we're finding out about Lindsay Lohan being arrested again, or whether Britney Spears has her underwear on. That's what we get. Out around the rest of the world, they get news. We get that crap, and we get it all the time. And we get the world. We do get world news. But we get it through the lens of whatever is the approved approach and policy coming out of Washington. If you want to know what's really going on in this world, you got to get your news from outside the USA. It's controlled here. Anybody who thinks there's a free press,
into X Squared Radio or the Kevin Smith Show, then you'll get the real news.
Well, that's true, but I'm talking about what is normally referred to as mainstream media. If you want to know what's really going on around the world, you got to go somewhere else to get it. All right, now the other thing, I think the reason that there were no military planes or helicopters up there is because either we are in collusion with, in cooperation with, whoever's flying those UFOs, or we've just had enough of our craft shot down by these things when we tried to go up and attack them that, you know, they're very serious about do not engage them. There is an order that they are not to chase or engage these UFOs.
Wow. Well, do most of the people in the Pentagon or outside the Pentagon think these they're friendly, or they're at least willing to help us get our act together if we become more peaceful in nature? I mean, do you think they're here to take over, to join us, or taunt us, or are they other ancient occupants of the earth that say, hey, we live here too, and we're just here looking and checking out and seeing what you're doing?
Well, I think it's a combination of those things. As far as what does the Pentagon think, who can know? Even if they tell you, you have absolutely no reason to believe what they say. These are the guys that told us, you know, they continually tell us things like swamp gas and weather balloons and Chinese wedding candles and, oh, it's the Maryland National Air National Guard dropping flares. They continually tell us this kind of stuff, and, you know, they basically have spent the last 60 years trying to tell us you didn't see a cow, it was a Cadillac. And we know what we saw. We know it was a cow, and they're trying to tell us it was a Cadillac. And so people don't have any real reason they want to believe official statements. And now as far as what are the UFOs doing here, I think it's foolish for us to think anybody's coming from somewhere else to rescue us. Are we rescuing the people being attacked in Syria? No. Well, why not? Because it's been determined in Washington that's not our business. It's not in our interest, and so are we going to rescue them? No. And, maybe those people on the ground in Syria are thinking, well, why doesn't the United States come help us? Well, because the United States officially doesn't want to and has no interest in it. Okay, I think if we think that extraterrestrials, just because they've got great technology, they've got wonderful toys, if we think they're more advanced than us in any other way, I think it's a mistake.
Sure, yeah, I agree with that, too.
Technologically advanced does not mean that you're advanced in any other way.
That's why we're not putting federally funded Kentucky Fried Chickens in Somalia.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. I've heard this. Brooks, you've heard it, too. Well, you know, I think extraterrestrials who travel between the stars and they've come all this way, and they've got the technology to get here, surely they have put their warlike tendencies behind them. Well, why would you suspect that? We can go to the moon. Did we get less warlike once we went there?
No.
Why would we suspect somebody else would have some kind of spiritual growth because they have better toys?
Well, that's exactly what my listeners are communicating to us. They're saying, you know, maybe Stephen Hawking wasn't wrong. Maybe we shouldn't be reaching out to these ETs. Maybe that's the last thing in the world we should be doing. Maybe we should not make the assumption that they're not hostile. And, you know, you and I both talk to the same sect out there. There's a whole community out there that believe that they're benevolent Pleiadians and Syrians, and they're here to help and, you know, trying to keep us from destroying our planet. Heck, you and I have seen mountains of evidence that ancient extraterrestrials came here and looted this planet of gold and copper for tens of thousands of years and may have been involved in manipulating our DNA to force us to help them do it.
I would say this. I've lived in a whole lot of places around the world. Now, if you were to ask me, are people in Bali, are they hostile or are they benevolent?
I would say they're benevolent based on what
you happen to be talking about. Some of them are hostile, and some of them are benevolent, and some of them, hey, they just don't care one way or the other. They've got their life to live, and you've got your life to live, so go on and do it and leave them alone. I think the extraterrestrials are the same way. Are they hostile? Maybe some of them. But look, this is important. This is very important. Just because you may be dealing with a group of extraterrestrials who are not exhibiting any hostility, that does not mean they are benevolent. They may just be neutral. They may just not really care what we do, or how we do, or to whom we do it.
Some people say, well, they could have wiped us off the face of the planet 1,000 years ago. All we really have to do is do a little excavation, like at Harappa, and you can see thermonuclear wars that took place 25,000 years ago and wiped out whole cities of civilians, killed them in the streets, holding hands as they were running for their lives. War has happened on this planet before with advanced weapons. And they may have all but wiped life from the face of the earth several times. And we're getting pretty close to the tipping point right now.
There's also this possibility. It's possible, Brooks, and this flies in the face of all established veins of thought about the history of the world. But there's the possibility that it wasn't extraterrestrials that used those advanced weapons. It's possible that it was our ancestors that bombed this planet back into the Stone Age, and we're just now crawling out again. And if you think that's impossible, ask yourself, are we just about to do it again? We are. We're on the edge of
pressing the button several times.
Again. I'm sorry.
Yeah, we've come close to pressing that button several times, and those are only the times we know about.
So it's entirely possible that this high technology that we know happened, we know those nuclear wars did take place, the weapons were used on this planet 25,000 years ago. It's quite possible it was us. Think what would happen. Think what would happen to this planet if a full-scale nuclear war took place. Civilization will be gone in a matter of hours. In a matter of two generations, the memory of it, of the high civilization, will be gone. There's no manufacturing for new clothes at that point. There's no manufacturing for new automobiles. There's no manufacturing for processing petroleum into fuel, gasoline, and diesel. It's gone. But we're talking about worldwide conflagration. You're into a nuclear winter. Two generations, the memory of the high civilization is mythology. And you're in the Stone Age again.
Yeah, I look at the Great Pyramid in Giza, which ostensibly was once covered with a beautiful, white, shiny limestone, which no living historian for the last 4,000 years has ever seen. It is a stripped version, a mere pile of rocks compared to what it was in its full glory. And yet the people of that great city of Cairo and the Giza area stripped that thing to the stones they couldn't pack away, like it was, as you said, a piece of mythology. I spoke to a guide who, she was just excellent the last time I was there. And I said, you know, what's up? You have the greatest historical set of artifacts on the planet. And yet when I go visit your sites, they're poorly kept. Getting in and getting out isn't monitored very much. The guys that are there will sell you anything that you want to chip off of a piece for a few pounds. I mean, what's going on? She said, you know, up until like 30 years ago, we didn't even know what that stuff meant. We didn't know how to read that stuff. We didn't know what it was for. It wasn't important. It was left by an ancient race. We didn't care about it. We're hungry people, and we needed money, so we sold what we could get our hands on, and we looted the rest. It's only recently that we've actually started managing the antiquities and used it as a revenue source for our country. And she couldn't have spoken more true words. That's exactly what would happen to the high society of this world. Within three or four generations, I'm convinced of it. We would be selling hubcaps for dinner plates. We would have no idea what this stuff was used for.
Well, that's right. Look, we've all seen pictures of Hiroshima after the atomic bomb. And that atomic bomb that was dropped on Hiroshima was a little tiny baby compared to what we have now, and we have them by the thousands. So,
yeah.
To a lot of other nations. A strike against, a nuclear strike against any major city now, with the construction, the type of construction we have, there's not going to be anything left standing. That city, the only thing left of that city is going to be the foundation. Maybe a few pieces of a few walls made of brick or stone. And the people who survive it, there will be a few adults, there will be a few children that survive it. They will remember what was there. But it will only be stories passed down to the next generation who will have no memory of it. They will pass it to the next generation, and at that point, it's just mythology. Because at that point, you're 70 to 100 years down the road from the event. And it's already becoming ancient history to you.
Oh, sure. Telling your kids that your great-great-grandfather used to fly in the air from this side of the continent to the other ocean thousands of miles away? Sure,
yeah.
He did.
Mm-hmm. It will sound like magic. And so it will become mythology. The professors and the teachers, 200 years after the event, their basic thing is going to be, even if that were all true, we don't live in that world. It's not available to us. We need to teach these kids how to live in the world we've got. And so, you know, the memory of the high technology will fade in like a vapor in the sun, just like that, it'll be gone. And who's to say that hasn't happened in our past?
Well, sure. You go back and read the Hindu Vedas and or the Sumerian texts, and we read about the Anunnaki and their genetic manipulation of whatever pre-human race was here to generate us with our limited lifespans. And their high-tech abilities to extract gold using sound and lasers. And, you know, we read those clay tablets today, translated by Zachariah Sitchin and expounded upon by countless others, not the least of which, you know, is the most recent Michael Tellinger's work. Just tremendous proof and evidence that this stuff was here. And yet, the archaeological and geological and anthropological societies refuse to even believe it.
Well, yeah, but now, Brooks, you know I'm excluding you from this statement because you've heard me make this, and I certainly am not including you in this. But establishment science, what's their batting average? How, you know, on how accurate they are? Let's see, that's who brought us the flat Earth. That's who told us the Earth was the center of the universe and put Galileo in house arrest for the remainder of his life because he had the nerve to look through a telescope. It was establishment science that did that. It was established. at that. They scoffed at the idea that you need to doctors need to wash their hands between patients. And they were killing their patients with infection as a result of this. It was establishment science that told us right up till 1995 that there are no planets out there around any other stars except right here in this solar system. Right up till 1995, that's what they told us. And of course, we know they're wrong. I'll give you another one. Establishment science has told us how many planets are in our solar system. And then they took their pencil and put a minus sign behind Pluto and said it's no longer a planet. These are the same people, the International Astronomical Telegraph Bureau. That's who notifies the world when there's a new discovery out there in space. All the astronomers have to report to them, and then it's up to that service to decide whether they're going to put it out to the rest of the world. And in 1973, a number of minor planets were discovered in our solar system that they decided, and I'm using their word, to suppress and did not notify their members, the professional astronomers around the world. They didn't even notify them of this. How do I know that? Because it's in their annual end-of-the-year statement for 1973.
Wow.
Establishment science their batting average is they're almost always wrong. I mean, they're the ones that scoffed at Albert Einstein's theory of relativity. Now, of course,
it's
been proven that he was right, and there's nothing they can do about it, so they just have folded on that one. But they made fun of the guy. They scoffed at him. That was establishment science. And they do the same thing now. Whenever someone comes up with an idea that the establishment guys didn't think of, they make fun of it. They scoff it. They ridicule it. Do their best to put this guy out of his career. They're almost always wrong.
Well, I know the late Dr. Van Flandern, who was he was on my program a couple times, and we talked about excuse me?
I said, yeah, he was on mine too. Great guy.
An awesome interview. And John published widely in astronomy, and yet in his own science, there were other astronomers that excoriated him for his observations of space and his publications.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, every inch of progress that has ever been made in terms of science has been progress made by the people that the establishment science said were wrong. But they weren't wrong. And, you know, I keep hearing about the laws of physics, the laws of physics, the laws of physics. And I'm going to tell you, I've said this to every physicist that's been on the show. There's no such thing as the laws of physics. They don't exist. Those are observations and then descriptions of our current understanding. That's all that is. And that's subject to change. Just like Einstein
changed
physics.
Even the basic ones like, the second law of thermodynamics, of entropy. Yes, when we talk about chaotic systems, everything does tend to go order to lesser order. That is entropy, unstoppable and irrefutable in the universe. And yet, when we look out at the universe in its chaos, we see about 5% of the universe that looks pretty organized in the form of stars and galaxies and clusters of galaxies and superclusters, all rotating in order. all generating oxygen and silicon and nitrogen and higher order elements spewing forth into space and forming the periodic chart, which we see, which looks pretty darn organized. I mean, a proton is a proton is a proton across the periodic table, with the exception of a little bit of weight gain or loss from hydrogen down to iron and back up to the higher order elements. But that looks pretty organized to me. That's order out of chaos. That it flies in the face of entropy. And yet, there it is, in your face.
Yes. Yeah, that's entropy in reverse. That's going from chaos to order. And, you know, one of the things that, when I talk about the laws of physics, one of the things that I throw out and people scratch their head and think about it, the physicists, is what if the speed of light is not the fastest speed that exists, but what if that's the lowest speed that exists? And here's why. If you go 1 centimeter faster, 1 centimeter per second faster than the speed of light, you have outrun light. You're now traveling at the speed of dark. And the universe is expanding faster than the speed of light, else we would see the bounce back, the reflection, off the edge of the universe.
Kind of gives a new meaning to dark matter, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. I think it's moving much faster than the speed of light. The speed of... Once you go faster than the speed of light, you have entered the speed of dark. And I think it's much, much faster. So the only reason we have light is because some of the matter slowed down to that speed.
One of my listeners writes in and says, that's all tier two science. So I wrote back and said, what's tier one science? And they wrote back and said, tier one science is the science we don't get until, like Einstein, it can't be denied by a moron, which, by the way, are the tier one scientists mostly holding up in our universities. Well, I don't even think they're universities, but I wrote back and said, so tier one science would be paranormal science, above normal. The tier two scientists are the throwbacks. Those are the ones that write our textbooks.
Yeah, your listener may be using an analogy from the IT world, in which you have tier one, tier two, and tier three. And tier three, that's the guys with all the super knowledge. But I think the super knowledge is in discovering, for instance, that everything, the universe and everything else, outside the universe, and I think there are other universes out there, but I think it's all a sphere. And the reason I think it's a sphere is because the universe is made of matter, and all matter in motion creates frequency, creates a wave of some kind if it's in motion, and all matter is in motion. And so, if it creates a frequency, all frequencies create harmonics, and the harmonics are given off of every frequency in 360 by 360 degrees. That's a sphere. This is the sphere, the spherical shape of things.
Yeah.
We see it from the macro to the micro to the submicro to the atomic and subatomic level. It's spherical. So I think the universe is a sphere. It's expanding. The reason it's a sphere is because it's all frequency. And we have receivers that can tune into certain frequencies. And those receivers are, we call it hearing, we call it sight. But our sight can only see a very narrow band of frequency. And it's slow-moving. It's the slow-moving that we see. We don't see the infrared. We don't see the X-ray. We don't see the ultraviolet because they're moving too fast.
Yeah, I see that. It's just a little too fast for visible. So it's either ultraviolet or infrared, but just out of our visible range. It doesn't mean it can't turn around and slap us in the face physically. We will see it,
right.
But we'll certainly feel it.
It's there, but we don't see it. And so what I'm saying is that what we see is in what we call the visible light range. That's the slow range. That's matter that has slowed down. And then we can see it. We cannot see. If gravity is a wave, it's a sphere. And we can't see it. We experience it, but we can't see it.
That's interesting. And you know, I call this the wouldn't it be neat if we could do this team. And, you know, it used to be us sitting around campfires talking about the wonder of science and the limits of known technology. And it's quite possible that the wouldn't it be neat if we could do this team gets the best funding, which comes from that $1.3 trillion U.S. defense budget, which I often say, defense against what? I mean, for crying out loud, we're battling armies in the back of a 1976 Datsun with a 50 caliber machine gun strapped in it. That's the army we're fighting. And unless I miss my guess, Kevin, we've been fighting those guys for a couple months, and they're winning.
Interesting, isn't it? But see, that brings up something else that's very important in our dealings with extraterrestrials. There is an assumption in the West that in Western civilization, that if you have superior technology, you will win. People who have Stone Age technology and a superior will win. Doesn't matter what the technology is.
I definitely think that's correct.
Well, we have fairly recent history of it. When the Russians went into Afghanistan to try to do what we are essentially trying to do, nation building, people using primarily Stone Age technology beat them.
Well, that's true. I mean, look at the human race compared to the Anunnaki. I mean, the Anunnaki were far superior to us, had longer lifespans, had much more experience, much more wisdom, better weapon systems. But we know how to do something really, really well. We know how to breed. And we know how to outnumber and overwhelm with desire. And now we control this planet.
Well, maybe we do. You know, there's some indication of not all the Anunnaki left, and there's some indication of where they went. Where they went, if the information is correct, might shock you. At the very time when the Sumerians were writing that their gods had deserted them and they were being overrun by other nations, right at that time, a group of people flew in and landed on top of a mountain thousands of miles away, and the description of those people was exactly the description the Sumerians gave of the Anunnaki.
And exactly.
So who they are? They are the Tuatha De Danann, who landed in Ireland. And the genealogy of their royal family that it takes them all the way back to Scythia, which is where the Sumerians had come from. They say they came from the north. You step out of Sumeria, headed north, you step right into Scythia.
So wow.
It's possible that the Tuatha De Danann, which is what the Irish called them, perhaps they are the same that the Sumerians called the Anunnaki.
Well, the Anunnaki were limited in number. Some say 200, some say 67, some say that they had names and that it's passed down through posterity as, you know, Semyaza or Samayil or Enki or Enlil and Marduk and all these names, and that the ziggurats were actually launch sites, and that there was a lot of similarity.
All those names are in the Sumerian or Akkadian or Chaldean language. But once they move somewhere else, the people there will use their language to name them.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I mean, we think that we're all sophisticated with our language, and yet look at the words that just this year, were added to our lexicon. Even abbreviations like BRB, that means be right back. Uh-huh. Holy cow, look at the things that are being added to our lexicon. How many people 30 years ago knew what click meant? Click on this. What? What do you mean click on what? What does click mean?
Yeah, right click. That'll really throw you. Yeah. Well,
Mac people still don't know what I'm talking about when I say right click.
Well, the thing about this migration is if these stories are true, then the rest of the story is that they went underground. They moved into the caves and built their civilization underground. So are they still
there? Isn't that what we're doing right now? We're building underground bases all over the world. Russia just announced they're building 5,000 more underground shelters.
Yeah. Yeah, well, underground is, I guess, the place to be if you're expecting some sort of solar flare or nuclear war or some sort of attack from those deep space forces that we've got satellites looking for, and that DARPA's building an intergalactic defense system for. So maybe underground's the place to be. We might run into some Anunnaki down there, some Tuatha De Danann.
Yeah, I think the question has been raised many times. Once we make the assumption that UFOs are real, once we make the assumption that there are other people flying through the skies of Earth beside man-made craft, then that realization puts us into a new realm of acceptance. Okay, they're here. Now, where are they parked? I mean, there's none parked here in southern Mississippi, I can tell you that. But they might be parked out in the deep waters of the Gulf of Mexico. They might be parked in the deep waters above the Arctic Circle, where we don't have any shipping lanes at all and no planes fly. They could live unfettered there for 200,000 years. We just don't go there. It's quite possible that there are whole civilizations of beings living on this planet in some level of technology we don't yet understand, sharing our world with us.
Well, it wouldn't surprise me. I get email once in a while that says, you sound like a reasonable, rational person, then you come up with something like this, and it makes me wonder. see, I think it's unreasonable and irrational to say that something cannot be simply because you have not seen it.
Yeah, I can see that.
I've used this example, and pardon me for using it now. If I were to tell you that there are bats, the little furry mammal that flies, if I were to tell you there are bats with a 6-foot wingspan, many, many, many people listening right now would say, he's lost it. A bat with a 6-foot wingspan? I assure you, they do exist. And the people in Indonesia, in some of the islands around Indonesia, raise them as a food source. And I have eaten them. And I have seen these bats in flight. They are huge. They have a 6-foot wingspan. But if you assume, because you've never seen one, that they don't exist, you would be dead wrong. And because they actually really do exist. Now, if anybody that wonders can go look up on Google for some videos and pictures of something called the fox bat or the flying fox, because it's got a snout like a fox. Not a fox, it's a bat. And
wow.
You can see those. Okay?
Now, do they eat fruit or do they eat people?
They eat fruit. They eat fruit.
Interesting.
And the people on a lot of these islands raise them domestically as a food source, like we raise chickens, you know. They use it as a food source. I've been asked, what do they taste like? Well, they taste like rat. And then I've been asked, well, what does a rat taste like? Well, especially folks in the South will know what a squirrel tastes like. Very similar to that.
Ah, interesting. Some of those squirrels are pretty tough.
Yeah. Yeah, some of those bats are, too.
Yeah, it depends on how old they are, I guess, when you kill them. But I would think that an animal that lives on fruit would taste pretty good.
Well, they're not bad. I mean, you know, my policy is if I come to your village and you offer me food, I eat it. I don't ask questions. If it's not killing you, it won't kill me. And so that's the way I do. And that's how I have ended up eating these bats. Didn't find out till later what it was, but that's okay. I would have eaten it anyway. And, you know, it's just different than what we're accustomed to here. But the same thing applies, Brooke, to someone that can use a gravity wave propulsion system. And we say, I've never heard of that. I've never seen that. It must not exist. Yeah, just like
well,
that.
Yeah,
with a 6-foot wingspan.
For 50 years, well, still today, we beat the air into submission by spinning a blade that looks like a wing. And now we develop speed. But somewhere along the line, someone had to compress air, put a little fuel with it, spit it out the back, and we licked the speed of sound like it was nothing.
Yeah.
Somewhere along the line, somebody learns how to gather up gravity, stick it in a can and amplify it and shove it out the back. Now you've got something that's faster than light.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, just because we haven't seen it is absolutely no basis for saying it does not exist. It really does exist. Somewhere. I'm convinced that our military has it, but I can't prove that. That's just my opinion, but I am personally convinced they've got it. And what convinces me is a non-military development of gravity wave communication. And if you can manipulate it for communication, you can manipulate it for propulsion.
Well, I would think so, although I'm having quite a bout with it myself. I don't like my readings against gravity. I think we should repeal the law of gravity. Yeah. It's holding us down.
Well, you know, is it true that the Earth has gravity, or does the Earth just suck?
I doubt that. Why else would gods come here in the first place?
Well, see, that's another thing. The people that decided they were gods were humans that decided these people that landed were gods. And, you know, if extraterrestrials land here, there are going to be people, I mean, if they land visibly right out there in the public square and everybody sees it, there are going to be people who will think these are gods, even today. And they're not. They're not gods. They're just people
understand what you mean. And we're not talking about Lady Gaga either. We're just talking about ordinary people with better toys. Well, I've got to take a break here. Going to pour some water down my throat. If you want to hang through a few minutes into the next hour, I'd really appreciate it, Kevin. If not, I understand too.
If you want me to stay, I'll stay, Brooks.
Excellent. Excellent. All right, we're going to take a quick four-minute break. Don't go away. More X Squared Radio coming in just a little bit. We're going to listen to some Sarah, and I thought it was appropriate. We'll be back right after this with more X Squared Radio.
Take me out of darkness, out of doubt, a long way down, with good intention.
Back to X Squared Radio. We're coming to you live from Southern Mississippi, and we are so glad you are here with us. Our toll-free number anywhere in North America, I know many, many of you are sitting out here. The network is absolutely full. But we would invite you to call in. My guest tonight is Kevin Smith. His radio program is kevinsmithshow.com, kevinsmithshow.com. By the way, he's the author of a book which I've interviewed him about on this program called Gods in the Garden. I would highly recommend that book. It will totally take you by surprise. Anywhere in North America, our phone number is 888-429-5471. Anywhere else, on planet or off planet, if you can reach a cell phone tower, you can get to us, 530-413-4515. And those of you that are out there listening by cell phone, in ever-growing numbers, we have had a little bit of technical difficulty with the conference line the last few minutes, but it's fixed. 760-569-7676. And the passcode is 192919 pound. Once you do that, you'll be able to walk around with a dumbstruck look on your face listening to X Squared Radio via Bluetooth. We invite you to do that. By the way, there's a recent publication out about the top 10 unexplained phenomena. Now, I don't know. This is pretty recent, but it's also pretty dated because the 10 things are the Taos hum, which those of you that know about Taos, New Mexico, have for years been annoyed by a puzzling and mysterious faint low-frequency hum in the desert air. Oddly, only a small number of people can actually hear it, but it's also unexplained. And, of course, intuition and mysterious disappearances, of course, deja vu, UFOs, which we've been talking a little bit about tonight, near-death experiences and life after death, psychic powers and ESP, which I can tell you right now the conclusion is some have argued psychic powers cannot be tested or for some reason diminish in the presence of skeptics or scientists. If this is true, science will never be able to prove or disprove the existence of psychic powers. This is absolute nonsense because psychic powers, including the ability to manipulate random number generators just using human intention, to manipulate the pH of water, has been definitely and irrefutably clinically proven. Dr. William Teller and Tiller and Gary Schwartz and others have already gathered this data, have already published and been accepted in multiple peer review papers. ESP does exist. You have it. I have it. Okay, I have it a little better than you do. But trust me, the mind is way far and above beyond the brain. Okay? And then, of course, there's the mind-body connection and ghosts, which we don't cover on this program. And Bigfoot. Come on. Bigfoot is in the top 10. Are you kidding me? I don't even think it rates in the top 10. You know, I have a top 10 for you. One of the top 10, it could be in the top 5 mysteries, is how in the world does our government operate continuously spending more money than it takes in? That's a top 10 mystery for you. Let me liken it to you like this. 10 guys sit down to play poker at a table. They each come with $1 million. But after a few days of playing poker, none of the people at the table can ante up. What? There was $10 million at the table and no one can ante up. No one can get in the card game because everybody at the table's broke. That's what's happened in our economy. That's what's happened in our economy. 10 million businesses have come to this country to play the game of business. We have put our money in, we've worked our buns off, we've sold, we've built, we distributed, and now all the money is gone. All the money is gone. Every bank is broke, every insurance company is broke, every state is broke, our government is broke. Where did the money go? Now that's a top 10 unexplained mystery. My guest tonight is Kevin Smith. Welcome back, Kevin.
Glad to be back. And based, Brooks, based on the establishment's definition of what is paranormal, anything for which there is no scientific explanation, that means that the government of the United States of America is 100% paranormal.
I love it. I love it. To be president of the paranormal nation. Wow. What a great book that would be.
The first paranormal president. Yeah, there's no scientific explanation. There's no rational explanation. There's no logic in it at all. And yet they continue telling us, if you let us do more of the same, it'll get better. That's paranormal.
That's insanity.
It is that.
You know, I am more astute than the average bear, and I'm pretty good at looking at statistics and weighing things, and I can pretty much tell when someone's lying. But I gotta tell you, the jury's still out for me. Every time I go into Washington, and when I step back out and I watch the news, I listen to the president speak, and I watch his body language. I listen to the force and energy he puts behind his words. I watch his facial expressions. He really believes what he's saying, and I really like what he's saying. I like alternative energy. I like solar energy. I like wind power. I like getting off of foreign oil. I like innovation and building up small business. But that's not what we see happening. And now I look at the president's popularity numbers below 40%, and I go, you know something? We might have somebody here. We might have somebody that's bucking the system so hard, trying to get something good going, that they're hell-bent to destroy this man. Because when I hear what he says, and I see the executive orders that he's writing, I go to the Pentagon and I talk to the people who are his appointees, and they believe with all their heart he's trying to do something great. But let it get two steps away into the budget office, into the Department of Energy, into the National Renewable Energy Lab, into the Department of Transportation, and it becomes twisted in some kind of money laundering scheme that pumps taxpayer money into global corporations who support what? Taxation without representation? Systems that don't work and can never work. And yet they consume trillions and trillions of dollars of taxpayer money and return nothing. No value added whatsoever. So the jury's still out for me. What's going on with this government?
If you took that same kind of behavior and transferred it to cells in your body, what would you call that?
Cancer.
What do you do with cancer?
You cut it out.
You cut it out. You starve it down. You get rid of it. And
chemotherapy.
I'm the most non-political individual that anybody could ever meet. There's not a political bone in my body. But I'm also not stupid, and I realize that there's a cure for what's going on. But that cure, the patient has to be told first, you have cancer. Then the patient has to be told, if we don't do surgery, it's going to kill you. And then the patient has to make a decision. And right now, we still have a country full of people that believe you can keep sending more of the same to Washington, and it's going to get better. All I can say is, America, you elected it. Love it.
Well, anciently, Paracelsus wrote, "Truly it has been said that there is nothing new under the sun, for knowledge is revealed and is submerged again, even as a nation rises and falls." Here is a system tested throughout the ages, but lost again and again by ignorance or prejudice. In the same way that great nations have risen and fallen and been lost to history beneath the desert sands and in the ocean depths. Are we that great nation? Are we that great nation, that great shining city on the hill, that great melting pot, that great hope of all the world? Or have we become the meddler central, where we're paying despots not to go to war with one another, and our foreign aid is nothing more than protectionism? Our empirical drive that was once so clearly outlined in the Monroe Doctrine has been twisted into something that cares for the interests of the United States of America and nothing else.
Well, like I said, I truly am the single most non-political individual you'll ever meet. And that is, you know, that precludes me from having much to say about anything that can be applied as a band-aid to what's going on. You know,
we come up with apolitical solutions here all the time. Fire them all. Fire them all and replace them. We can't find 535 good people in this country. We're hurting worse than I thought.
I think the Constitution is a really remarkable document. And to the degree that we followed it, we were free. And we were looked upon with high respect. Now, to the degree that we are not following it, we are not free, and we're not looked upon with high respect to that same degree. People who have made their career out of bashing the Constitution and getting around it every which way they can't fix this.
Yeah. Well, if we shift our conversation back to what we were talking about and drift away from this political morass that our media seems to stir up like a big plate of gumbo every morning and then feeds us a spoonful every 30 minutes, 24 hours a day. One of my listeners writes in, here's an example of how bright minds think about knowledge now. In this space age, if that's what we want to call ourselves, with its remarkable technological advances, it is becoming apparent that the, quote, miracles of other seemingly supernatural events reported in ancient texts, the megalithic constructions and the enigmatic lines and artwork over the earth, resulted from an advanced technology which was incomprehensible and indescribable by the ancient human observers. These ideas are supported by the assumption that ancient myths are not myths, but historical and scientific texts. We have had great societies that have reached zeniths much greater than our society today, much more unified than our society today. And I think the evidence, like you said before, Kevin, has been swept beneath tidal waves and high winds and the machines of war until the survivors could not describe it and certainly couldn't operate it again until just now.
Well, I think that's exactly right. I had someone on my show as a guest not long ago, and I was trying to explain, I was trying to give an example of how things can be slightly out of phase. And I was using the example of the old radios that had a tunable dial instead of the digital selector that we have now. And I said, you know, you remember how you could turn that and you'd be slightly off frequency and you'd be picking up part of a signal in the background from some other station far away?
Uh-huh.
This person had never seen a radio with a dial.
No.
Okay. Had no idea what I was talking about. All right. That's a good example. Radios with a dial, well, that's only 20 years ago.
You're exactly right. The old, and you know, for listeners that are too young to remember this, but radios used to have, and TVs too, used to have an air capacitor in them. Two plates that looked a little bit like two flat combs coming together, separated by half a millimeter or so by air. And twisting one set of plates into the other one, sort of merging them together, changed the capacitance of this air capacitor and thus would change the frequency that the set was tuned to. Now, for TVs, that was a click. We clicked from channel 2 to 3 to 4 up to 13, and then we had UHF channels, which were a little bit more tunable in between the clicks. But the frequency control was kind of iffy in those days. It couldn't actually stay right on channel. So sometimes it would kind of fade in and fade out. We'd get snow, and as time went on, we got better and better controlling the frequencies. But radios were like that too. And you didn't tune to 102.5. It was more like 102.4937, and you could get that with that air capacitor. But you could tune manually to sort of the upper sideband of that, and you could just catch another channel that might be 5,000 miles away or in another language that somehow was skipping space that night or skipping across the ionosphere, and you could pick it up. I tried to explain to my kids, turn it clockwise. Turn that clockwise and it'll go down. And they look at me with the dumbest look on their face. You know, clockwise, counterclockwise. They had no clue what I was talking about because they've never seen a clock that wasn't digital.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, we live now with the most vulnerable generation that has ever lived since we've been living. And it's not because they're stupid. It's because they haven't been exposed to things that are non-digital. They live in a digital world. And all it takes is one good EMP blast, and that's over.
Or one solar storm.
I'm sorry?
Or one solar storm.
Oh, yeah, and that's it. Boom, that's it. The digital world disappears instantly if that happens. And they don't know. I've talked to people where I talk about a slide rule, and they have no idea what I'm talking about. They've never seen one. Well, I can tell you this. You'll be finding one as quick as you can if you're an engineer. You'll find one as quick as you can if that solar flare hits or an EMP blast takes place, because that's the only computer you'll have.
And you're going to remember what logarithms are for.
Mm-hmm. And you're actually going to have to understand what is sine, cosine, and tangent. I mean, you're actually going to have to know something and know its function and what it does. And, you know, this is the most vulnerable generation there is, that there has ever been, and at least in our lifetimes, and in recorded history that we know about. There's never been a generation more vulnerable than this.
Yeah, and you're going to have to know what 8 times 9 is manually.
Yeah. That's spooky, huh? And perfect numbers, you'll have to know something about that. And, you know, but anyway, we're living on the edge of extinction as a result of our high technology. And it's not just because we can blow the world up. It's because we've blown up the reason to know things.
Well, there's been a recent study out that the human mind is beginning to change. what they're seeing as mental patterns in people now are different than they were 30 years ago. And I've often made the comment on this program, and I know you have on your program, that the internet since 1996 has been fairly accessible to almost everybody. In 1996, we was the dawn of high-speed internet. We started to go away from dial-up modems and get into cable modems and things that were quick enough that we can actually really communicate with one another. And cell phone towers became more and more prevalent to where we really didn't have gaps on any major highway in our country, which I can tell you in the 80s, we never thought we would see cell phones. We heard about them, but we never thought we would see them because, heck, the power was in the phone back in the 80s. You carried around a 5-watt phone that had some range. Now you carry around a phone that has a quarter of a watt because the towers can pick up that weak signal and amplify it to the next station. That's where cell technology came from. But we thought it was 50 years away. No, in 10 years, the cell phone towers were almost everywhere, and they're adding them all the time because they make money, because people pay for those minutes to be on the air, which costs them virtually nothing once the infrastructure is paid for. The bottom line is that we have rewired the neural network of the human mind because we've connected each other, just like we're doing tonight. Kevin's in Arizona, I'm in Mississippi, and you're everywhere on the planet, and we're talking real time. We're communicating. We're spreading ideas. We're getting to know each other. We're breaking down barriers and prejudices. We're opening lines of communication, and we're able to access the greatest Alexandrian library in human imagination. You can learn every waking hour as fast as you can possibly learn. And I guarantee you, smart people are doing that right now. Self-driven, self-motivated geniuses are pouring information from the internet into their minds and expanding their imaginations and their capabilities and their aptitude at a rate unprecedented in human development. Of course, the human mind is rewiring itself. I mean, I see 80-year-olds out there texting one another. Everyone has changed, have they not?
Not everyone. I haven't.
No, I suppose you're not.
Look, you know, I don't have a cell phone. I will not have a cell phone. And there are people that tell me, oh, that's silly, that's foolish. Okay, that's fine. I will not have a cell phone. But the primary reason I won't have a cell phone is this. You know what my work schedule is? You know, I work about 20 hours a day. If uh-huh. I'm at my desk, when you call, I'll answer. If I'm not at my desk, that means I'm off duty. I don't want to be called. So,
I got that.
I don't carry. I'm not. I'm not continually plugged in. I don't carry a cell phone. It's well. Look, in my case, it's the only way. Absolutely, the only way I can have any free time is to get up and walk away from the desk.
Well, that's true. I mean, I have a one day job at least. And then, you know, I dabble in all kinds of engineering and science, and my every waking hour, I'm doing something. And even when I sleep, I'm building something. I'm writing or doing something. And I wake up, I bring it into this dimension, but my mind is going all the time. And I'm sure that you and I are not alone. There are lots of people that work our schedule out there, and they are affecting the universe.
Yeah. And, you know, and like I say, though, in my case, I've got high technology all around me. That's what I work with all the time. By high technology, I'm talking about communications technology. And I work with it all the time. But when I get up and walk away from the desk and I go take a coffee break or I go take a walk, I don't want to be disturbed. And the only way I can manage that is, can't get in touch with me unless I'm on duty at the desk. So, but yeah, I see that hide. I'm not hiding anything in my bed, but these guys aren't going to come sleep with me.
Yeah, I understand that. But my point was, and the point of this paper that was written, is that the neural network of humanity is changing. Our ability, or at least government's ability, to say those guys over there, those are the bad guys, is going away. Because we're able to communicate with the people over there. We're able to exchange art and music and fall in love with each other and write to each other and send pictures back and forth and join each other's Facebooks. The barriers are breaking down, and we are becoming a global community.
Well, that is true. That is true. And that's a good thing. But it has some consequences to our ability to think logically and rationally as well. And a good example is something we started out talking about earlier, and that is the idea that extraterrestrials, are they hostile or benevolent? They don't have to be either one. They do not have to be either one. They don't have to be hostile, and if they're not, that doesn't mean they're benevolent. See, both of those are active descriptions. They may just be busy, not interested in us. You know, I'm not hostile to an ant bed. I'm not benevolent either.
Yeah, but let the ants invade your kitchen and see what happens.
When they invade the kitchen, they've got to die. And I think that's true if we invade the world of, the domain of, any extraterrestrial race. I think that's the same thing. I think they want to be left alone, most of them. And I think we would like to be left alone. You know, what's the number one reason people want to have contact with extraterrestrials? For what we can get out of them. For the military, they want to have contact because of the technology they can get. And for the people that are on the more spiritual kind of track, because of all the wonderful spiritual things we can learn from them. Everything is we motivated. It's all terracentric motive. I'll get it said in a minute. It is terracentric motivated. What can we get from them?
Sure. Yeah, exactly. Tell us how to travel the way you travel. We want to go where you go. Or better yet, tell us how to build a better weapon system using your technology. And, you know, that's not, they're not alone. The military isn't the only one that's leeching money out of the taxpayer to do what they want to do. We have whole other industries which are almost as large. Look at the pharmaceutical industry. I mean, there are cures. That is to say, you've taken your last pill, you've had your last surgery, you've had your last injection. Cures that are known, and yet they will not let them be disseminated among the people. And if anybody tries, they're going to jail, and everything they own is going to be confiscated.
Yeah. That's because there's money and death and disease.
Well, there's money and suffering. I mean, come on, pain relief is a multi-billion, it could be a trillion-dollar industry by now. One of my listeners writes in and talks about skin cancer. There's a drug that has been developed that is using immune cells. And when people with skin cancer have been injected with this drug, the longest duration of a response so far seen in a patient who recovered one quarter of their dose, or received one quarter of their dose after 13 months, he remains free of blood cancer. I mean, there are cures out there, and doctors are saying, well, this is exciting. It's exciting? You mean 150,000 people in Europe at any given moment are suffering from cancer? At any given moment, the people die, people are re-diagnosed, or diagnosed back into the system where it's lung cancer, prostate cancer, breast cancer, colon cancer. It's out there. Cures are available. And yet pain and suffering is huge money. Cures are not.
Well, again, back to extraterrestrials. A lot of people say that we need contact with the extraterrestrials because they may have the knowledge of how to cure all of these things. Okay, do you think that the power structures on this planet are going to allow the dissemination of that knowledge?
Well, they would be signing their own bankruptcy notices if they did. I mean, look at the research and development teams, the activists and the lobbyists that they have pounding the doors of the FDA 24 hours a day. Look at all that that would go away if cures were released.
Well, that's why, you know, I think in the so-called UFO community, which is really not a community, but in the world of UFO enthusiasts, there are a lot of misconceptions that really hamper us being able to focus and get what information can be gotten. People talk about all the wonderful benefits if we had contact. Those are assumptions. There may be some benefits, and if there are, wonderful. We'll find out about it after this contact. But that cannot be the reason that motivates us to do investigation and research.
Sure, sure. Once you make contact, you can't uncontact. Oh, by the way, we didn't really learn what we thought we were going to learn. We're not really happy with this relationship, so we'd rather uncontact. You go back to being on your side of the known world, and we'll stay on our side.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, we're not focused, and because we're not focused, we're kind of like a flashlight instead of a laser.
Hmm.
So we shine a little bit of light on this and on that. But only a laser cuts metal. Flashlight will never do it. And so if we want to cut through the barriers and cut through the nonsense and get to what can be known, we have to focus. And, it can't be, we can't take the scattered approach of, well, we can get technology from them, we could get free energy from them, we could get cures to all these diseases from these extraterrestrials. You know what? You might not get anything. You might get nothing. And so that can't be the reason that we go in search. It can't be. But you brought up something a few minutes ago about how, you know, if there's some big disaster and all the major cities are blown away and the digital age is over in the blink of an eye. Just a few generations down the road, they would not even recognize and know how to even use any piece of technology they found.
Right.
I'll go a step further. They might not even recognize it as technology. And I think that's very possible. I think it's very possibly true with a lot of the ancient discoveries or discoveries of ancient things that have been made by archaeologists. I think it's quite possible that we have sitting in some of our museums some fantastic high-tech stuff, but because it doesn't look like ours, we don't even recognize it as high-tech. All of our high-tech stuff has to have a power source. And there are recognizable things about power sources. Unless this technology that we don't recognize as technology is powered by setting it on the top of a certain type of rock. And it draws energy from that, or it draws energy from setting it on the ground, you know, ley line. I think it's possible we have pieces of high technology from the past that we don't even recognize as technology.
Yeah, I think I've seen some of that out in the deserts of Egypt. I've seen the world's largest machined piece of alabaster sitting on top of a solid mica slab. Now, the differential in frequencies and capacitance between these two materials creates a natural static charge. Under the right conditions, this can generate a lot of voltage. And when you look at the complex and the stone machined bowls, and I'm not talking about carved, I'm talking about machined bowls of alabaster about 1 meter across, believe me, well, okay, it might take a rocket scientist, but I was there. I can tell you there was electroplating going on at this place. They used this site to electroplate other things, copper things or brass things, with gold. That's what it was there for. Now, the interesting thing is that this complex has completely been blown to pieces. Red granite blocks blown in every direction out into the desert sands. This thing exploded. It had a lot of energy built up in it.
Do you think it exploded from the energy that was built up in it, or do you think it exploded because someone didn't want it there and they attacked it?
Well, that's a good question. I have very carefully examined these blocks that were blown out of the way. I've looked for carbon, like you would see in some kind of explosive device. I looked for burns. I looked for evidence that this thing might have been, you know, shot with some kind of missile or had a bomb dropped on it. It isn't there. However, I did find red granite out in the sand that was not charred, but turned blue on one side from high temperature. If this thing did blow up, it was by electricity. Some, like, struck by lightning electricity. But I can tell you, they don't have lightning storms in Cairo. It hardly ever rains
maybe
in Cairo.
Maybe a plasma beam weapon?
A plasma beam weapon, yes. That would cause the markings that I noticed on these blocks at this particular structure. Absolutely.
Yeah. I know you know this. Cairo is the Egyptian word for Mars.
I did not know that. I'm writing that down. Cairo is the Egyptian word for Mars.
Yeah.
And on Mars, there's a pyramidic structure.
There are three pyramids laid out in the same formation as the three on Giza.
And you can see them from space.
That's correct.
So today,
Cairo is the Egyptian word for Mars. And there are some striking similarities between ancient Egypt and the planet Mars. Certain features on the planet Mars, yeah.
Opportunity is the surviving twin of two robot rovers that were placed up there 3 years ago. They have, well, Spirit lost communication a year ago. They have stopped trying. Its solar cells gave up in the last Martian winter. But Opportunity just arrived at the edge of a very large crater on Mars, and is about to sample the soil that we have never seen before. You know, I love these little rovers. I talked to Dr. Jim Bell at Cornell University. They run these rovers and talked about the challenges and of communicating with them and the wonder that they have lasted well beyond their original mission. But I have to wonder, you know, it's been a long time since we put any kind of rover up there, and these two were so wildly successful and low budget at that. Why we haven't gone back with more and checked out these internationally famous sites on Mars? Why haven't we checked out Cydonia? Why haven't we checked out these pyramids from the ground level and reported back what's on Mars. We could see from space, okay, it looks like a pyramid. We're rolling up on it now. It's just a rock. It's just a mountain. Why haven't we gone back and checked out these structures?
Maybe we have. In 1998, there was a workshop at Los Alamos. And this workshop, sponsored by NASA, was to bring scientists of many disciplines together to design a water drilling mission to Mars. The workbook and minutes of this working group at Los Alamos made it out. In 2000, I found it on the internet, and I broadcast about it for a solid week. And the place where they were going to do this mission was Cydonia. And there's an fabulously interesting statement in their minutes. And when it came to deciding what type of drilling device would be used, it was determined that they would use the, and I quote, proven successful lunar drilling technology of the Russians.
What?
Proven successful lunar, actually, the quote is, proven successful Russian lunar drilling technology. So who knew the Russians were drilling on the moon? If it's proven successful lunar drilling technology, that means they've tested it and proven it successful on the moon.
Or that we use their technology to drill on the moon, but I don't remember hearing about us doing that.
No, but that was in the minutes from symposium. Actually, it was not a symposium. It was a workshop. But it was held at Los Alamos in 1998. So if they had decided way back then that they were going to use this proven successful Russian lunar drilling technology, it's quite possible that by now they've done it, and we don't know about it.
Wow. That's really stunning. One of my listeners writes in and says, okay, what about the two Russian probes that went to Phobos, the two robot probes that were shot out of the sky, and the last picture taken was of a missile 50 yards away coming right at the Phobos probe.
Yeah, that was, I think, 1982. It was either 1980 or 1982. By the way, folks, I'll answer that, but you need to be aware there have been more missions to Venus than there have been to Mars. How come you don't hear about those?
Wow, to Venus.
Yeah, pretty interesting. Okay, this was Phobos 2. Phobos 1 was lost on the way to Mars. Phobos 2 achieved orbit. It photographed the surface of Mars, and it actually photographed a very interesting huge elliptical shadow down on the surface of Mars, and that shadow was moving. It turns its camera spaceward towards Phobos to see if it can get a picture of what's causing this shadow. It starts taking pictures. The last picture it took shows a long cigar-shaped object. Some people have said that's a missile. Some people have said that is a mothership. I don't know. It's something like 16 miles long. And there it is. So what about it? Somebody's there, and they don't want us to do what we were doing. That, incidentally, was an international mission being led by the Russian Space Agency.
Wow.
So somebody is there and doesn't want us to be doing what we were doing. Here's another mystery for you, though. The Mars Global Surveyor was a satellite that did yeoman workship around Mars. I mean, it took so many pictures, it was unbelievable, and we're still getting some pictures that had not yet been released. Every once in a while, there's a few pictures that come out that had not yet been released from the Mars Global Surveyor. And the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, the new satellite, had just been put in orbit around Mars. The Mars Global Surveyor was still in orbit and still working. It goes around behind Mars, and we lose contact with our satellites when they get to the backside of Mars, and we reestablish contact when they come around the other side.
Yeah, that makes sense.
It didn't phone home, and they kept trying to reestablish contact with it, and it didn't phone home, and they couldn't reestablish contact. So they took the Mars Global, Reconnaissance Orbiter, which has the high-rise, high-definition optics package on it. They turned the cameras toward where Mars Global Surveyor should be. Not only was it not there, there was no debris. Now, there's been a lot of people say, well, you know, it must have encountered some problem and it got blown up. Where's the debris?
Yeah, there would be something.
Yeah, it just was gone. It just disappeared. It was gone.
Well, whatever took it out of its orbit wasn't there either and had to take it while it was on the opposite side of the planet from the Reconnaissance Orbiter. So it was an intelligent move.
Would seem so, yeah. Did you know that we have 7 old satellites around Mars that are still functioning and you never hear about them?
I had no idea. I know Marsis is still up there. That was put up before the 2 rovers, but I did not know we had other satellites going around Mars that were still active.
They're still functioning, and NASA keeps communication tabs with them. Did you know that we have a communication satellite in orbit around Mars?
What do we need a communication satellite going around Mars for?
Well, that is a good question, isn't it? Communicating with who? Now, the reason that I know that we have a communication satellite around Mars is because there was a plan to fly an airplane on Mars. That airplane, it wasn't just somebody's pipe dream. They actually built it. And they test flew it in our upper atmosphere. I'm talking about an airplane with wings. I'm not talking about a rocket. Folks, NASA's official story is that the atmosphere on Mars is so thin, it's so absolutely thin, that you cannot even have liquid water on Mars.
I've heard that.
That's their official story. If that's the case, how are you going to fly an airplane?
Yeah, they fly like a brick.
They had a budget cut, and they had to choose between a couple of different projects, so they scrapped the airplane in favor of putting a communication satellite up around Mars.
Kevin, I would love to go on and on about this, but we are completely out of time. In fact, we're about 5 minutes over. As always, it's been a tremendous pleasure to have you on the program, and I look forward to being on yours.
All right. Thank you.
We're going to do, what are we doing, Thursday night at 9 p.m.?
That's right. Thursday night, 9 p.m. Central Time, 10 p.m. on the East Coast. That's 7 p.m. out on the West Coast. And Dr. Brooks Agnew will be my guest.
Outstanding. I look forward to it, sir. I got to go.
All right. Thanks.
Good night. All right. That's it for X Squared Radio. I'm going to play my exit music, and we're out of here. Sorry for running long, my friends.
It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station, and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people, and help it to grow a little every day, and before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio saying, peace, Earth Explorers. Thank you.